found that it seems like if you're within 100 yards of those herd bulls, it seems like it's, as long as they, you know, you don't shock them by not saying a word and then coming in and bugling right on top of them. But if they know that something's in the area, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you're there, it's not so shocking. There's so many things that can go wrong. And if you get focused on not the big picture, but you get, you know, focused on little things, it's so easy to overlook those bigger things that can all get you. I hunt by myself quite a bit. So a lot of times I end up trying to gauge their aggression and close on them and just kind of read all of that stuff and balance it all out. But I will try to put something that's not going to stop them, but will make them more likely to not expect to see some, you know, not expect to see that animal calling until they're within range. I guess the biggest thing is if you're bringing new hunters, especially ones that have absolutely no experience in, you know, just like that mental toughness of being able to push through the suck fest of climbing some hill for an hour and a half in the dark. Just have your expectations a little bit lower and try to, especially with kids, try to make it fun,
right,
as much as possible. I mean, there's only so much fun you can have when you're walking 25 yards and stopping for a breath because the hill's too steep.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. A couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code John Stallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt, Days in the Wild Outfitters, and we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we are going to continue with the Lessons Learned series, and I got my buddy Doran Larner on the phone with us, and we are going to talk a little elk. What's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. Just trying to not melt away. We've got not much moisture and pretty high temperatures. Nothing like Arizona, though.
I was going to say, you want to trade?
No,
it's like it's been like 115 degrees for like 2 weeks straight. Yeah, it's bad. Yeah, we got a little rain last night, actually, just a touch, but not enough to send enough.
We
to
had 107 or 8 about a week and a half ago, and it was an all time high.
Really?
Yeah, and it was miserable. Nobody was enjoying it.
Yeah,
and we've got some fire stuff. Yeah, pretty high fire danger. Have had a couple of fires around up in the mountains already, which is pretty early for this. You know, for that to start this early is potentially bad.
Yep, for sure. I'm really fearful for our deer herd here in Arizona right now because it's been basically, well, 3 years ago we had pretty decent rain. Or 3 seasons ago, I wouldn't say 2 or 3 years ago, 3 seasons ago, we had pretty decent rain. But 2 years in a row, we had terrible drought. Last year and the year before was like the two highest success rates that we've had on both the rifle and archery seasons. So a lot of deer were taken out of the herd. And it's just, I don't know. I know we're going to, so like we took 23 deer last year as outfitters, 23,
yeah.
three mule deer or four mule deer, and the rest were all coos deers, but which in the grand scheme of things is really doesn't, it's not a lot, but we're going to cut back. We're not going to take as many people this year because we kill off the research. I mean, the resource, it's, you know, then there's not going to be anything for us down the road. And I just really concerned about, you know, the status of the herd right now, just because what I've seen and the caliber of deer feels, I feel like a lot of the units that we hunt are, I hate to use the word shot out, but shot out seems like the only way that the people going on the, you know, visualize it, understand it. It's just all the what's the word I'm looking for? Age class has been taken out of those units. And it's like, oh geez, you know, we got to give it, we got to give it a little break.
So. Do you think that ban on the game cameras will help that age class a little?
You know, so the problem we were having with the trail camera thing was just in a handful of units, like up on the Kaibab, the Strip, Unit 9, and Unit 10 for elk, Unit 9 and 10 for elk, and for deer. Both those units really didn't really see the same issues with running cameras anywhere else. Like you don't have, we didn't have confrontations down in the desert, you know? So I don't think it's going to have a positive effect. I don't think it's going to do what they wanted, what they wanted to do, what they're implying that it's going to do. What they really wanted to do is their phone to stop ringing with people bitching about having confrontations on water holes. And guess what? That's not going to stop. It's not going to stop.
No.
Because the assholes who are doing it are probably still not going to, or they're not going to follow the law anyway. It's still going to have those problems. So it's just from an enforcement standpoint, the whole thing is a ridiculous endeavor anyway. I don't know a single game and fish guy that I've spoken to that stands behind the idea of having to ban cameras, because he's like, you're moving one enforcement problem to another enforcement problem. You know, the first one was people were getting into arguments because somebody was hunting the hole, the water hole, and then somebody would come in while they're hunting and check the camera.
Oh,
that would cause a confrontation. That's the whole reason why they're getting rid of the, you know, trying to get rid of the trail cameras. Has nothing to do with preserving the deer herd. Nothing at all.
Okay.
So anyway, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now because I could talk about it for a long time.
I understand.
Anyways, so if you could share with us a couple stories.
You bet.
I appreciate it.
You bet. So these stories are mostly related to obstacles and terrain in regards to archery hunting.
Okay.
So one time I was hunting with a buddy of my dad's. I was, I don't know, 14, 15, something like that. And we were going up through a deadfall mess following a herd bull that would, you know, just maintain that distance of a couple hundred yards ahead of us and to a quarter mile ahead of us. And we were just dogging up behind him, waiting for him to bed down. So hopefully we could get a confrontation going and just kind of kept him bugling so that we could keep tabs on him and keep following him.
Were you bugling at him to keep him going, or are you cow calling?
No, we were bugling at him. That was actually before a lot of the decent cow calls that you have now. So I think I couldn't do a diaphragm at that time. I hadn't figured them out. And I think the only cow call on the market really that I was aware of was that one from Elk Incorporated. It was kind of a plastic one with rubber bands.
I've seen it, never used it. I know what you're talking about.
It works well, but it's problematic to keep in your mouth and be at a draw, because when you release you can catch it.
Gotcha.
Because it kind of sticks out a little bit. But yeah, so we were just bugling and following him, and we got up to where he had finally stopped for the day, for the morning, and got him fired up. And what we didn't recognize that out there at about 50, 60 yards was we had, you know, about 30, 40 yards in front of us of decent opening. And what we didn't recognize is that there was kind of a wall of like shorter trees, like junipers or spruces, something like that. Mm-hmm. It's been long enough ago. I don't remember what they were, but you know, they were 10, 20 foot tall trees and pretty limbed out instead of the lodgepole that we had kind of been walking up through. And right in the midst of that was a whole bunch of deadfall. And he came into about 60 yards, just fired up, but he didn't want to cross that obstacle. He just, it was more work than he was willing to put in. And he had come far enough away from his cows that he wasn't coming any further if he had to work at it. Mm-hmm. So kind of what I'd learned from that was to pay attention to what's out there at that, you know, that, I don't know, a lot of times, especially the herd bulls seem to want to hang up around that 50 to 80 yards, and you don't always have a clear shot, and a lot of people couldn't or shouldn't be shooting past 50 yards anyway, even if it was a perfectly open hillside with no wind or anything. So what I've gotten to where I pay attention to what's out there at that distance. Mm-hmm. And I try to visualize where an elk might walk if he's coming from that direction. So that, I try to look for that path of least resistance and try to position myself to where I'm hoping he's coming down that path of least resistance, and I'll be within range of that path.
Yeah. No, that's huge. Actually, that I did a whole seminar on that last year, with West Coast Archery. It's on my YouTube if anybody wants to see it. I call it building the room. I heard of Chris Rowe. I listened to some of his stuff too. He talks about, calling it the doorway or something like that. I've forgotten how he refers to it, but you're doing the same thing that I do, and I'm sure a lot of good callers do, is you're identifying the hang up spots, and
yeah,
and you're trying to put yourself in a position that is going to allow you, or is going to allow the bull to come to an area that when he hangs up, he's going to be within the kill zone.
Yeah.
And that's basically what it is. Like, so, you know, every animal, doesn't matter, elk, turkey, deer, predators, whatever, they're going to get to a certain point where they feel like they should see whatever it is that they're hearing. And if they don't see what they're hearing, then they're going to stop and try to either one, circle around and get your wind, or they're just going to stop and stare until they can confirm with their eyes that the sound is coming from what they think it's coming from.
Probably all the stories that I could come up with that I could think of are similar in, their topic is mostly setup, you know, kind of trying to get your setup right. The next one that I thought about was I went up hunting this place that has like four or five different little finger ridges. And I went up the middle one and they're all, you know, at the most, to go around the drainage, it might take you an hour to get from one finger ridge to another, but most of them are only 200-400 yards apart. So, you know, you can, as long as the wind isn't blowing, you can easily hear something that's bugling on one of those ridges if you chose the wrong one to go up. Mm-hmm. And I had a bull bugle. I was still fairly young and I did a lot of solo archery hunting, partially because I didn't really care what I shot, and my dad was always wanting to shoot a big bull, and had my stepmom with him And I thought three was a crowd a lot of times. So I was up there on these one of those little finger ridges, heard a bull bugle, got him bugling, got him fired up, closed the distance a little bit, and he just came roaring over. And he came over, you know, I'd assume I didn't see him because it was thick, but it was pretty fast, so he must have been trotting the whole way. And I had set up and had, you know, had a good background of tree cover, and I'd set up a little bit shying on this ridge towards where he was coming from, but the ridge was, I don't know, it was probably crested about 15 yards from me, 15, 20 yards from me, and I was off to the side that he was coming from, and he walked around that head of that little drainage and came right down the point of the ridge, but he shaded towards the opening. So when he came in, he was 20, 25 yards away from me. Mm-hmm. And all I could see was the top third of him because the grasses and the ridge line. So, you know, that was kind of another example of not paying attention to my sight lanes, you know, considering he might not pinpoint you exactly. Mm-hmm. He came in a little higher, so of course he's going to have to come down the ridge, and I didn't think about that. And you know, the end result was I'm sitting there at full draw with a bull, and it was just a raghorn. Mm-hmm. At, you know, 20, 25 yards, an easy kill shot, even, you know, even back then with the crummy slow bows that we had, that was an easy shot. And I had to watch him walk away because he looped around and he stayed over there out in the stuff that was a little bit more open and just staying.
I was waiting for you to tell me you shot him in the head. I was just joking.
No, I wasn't. Yeah, that was pre-range finders, so I needed a little margin of error because I was okay. I had one of those dial-in range finders.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That would look like double vision if.
Yep.
Until you got it on the right range. But even those weren't. No, super accurate. And with those slow bows, you had to have a little bit of margin of error in there.
Oh yeah. Yep.
The next story is kind of similar. I was on one ridge. We had gotten into these elk and I had heard them. I'd heard them that morning, I think. And I went back that evening. Yeah, you know, I didn't harass them because it was kind of a small little spot and I knew that they weren't likely to go anywhere. So I came back that evening and I went down this little ridge. I came in from the top and I went down this little ridge and came in pretty early and sat there and waited. This bull fired up and started bugling late afternoon. And he was down in the bottom of this drainage, likely getting water because it was early and still pretty warm. And, I went down there after him. By the time I got down there, he'd worked back up to the top of the, not the ridge I went down, but the one right next to it. So I kind of circled in behind him and got the wind right. And I was coming up the ridge and I still had plenty of daylight. So I was just working my way up the ridge because I knew he had cows. So I wanted to get pretty close to him before I started bugling. And, found that it seems like if you're within 100 yards of those herd bulls, it seems like it's as long as they, you know, you don't shock them by not saying a word and then coming in and bugling right on top of them. But if they know that something's in the area, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you're there, it's not so shocking. And I came in, I got within, I don't know, 45, 50 yards of the cows. And they were out in the opening. I didn't dare go any closer because there were too many of them. And I didn't think I could close that distance before it got too dark. I bugled and he immediately just hammered me and came running. He was on the other side of the cows. I couldn't see him, but he came running and just hauled right at me without a care in the world. And I was at full draw when he came through the timber. But what I didn't recognize is that I was standing about 2 yards off of a game trail, and that's what he was coming down.
Oh, shit.
But it was just enough of an angle, and it was just dark enough that I tried a frontal shot because I was only 10 or 15 yards away.
Jesus.
And it was just dark enough that I thought I had the right spot, and you know, the pins weren't as good as they are now for gathering light. I thought I had the right spot, but I was off to the side a little bit, and ended up with about 6 inches of penetration before I hit bone.
Oh, yeah.
And watched him run off with my arrow flop, and it fell out within about 2 leaps, and he circled around and went right back to his cows. So that was another one of those, get caught up in the moment and not pay attention to all the details, you know, not look for that trail. I'd kind of got tunnel vision with those cows being right there and totally forgot to look for the trail. And on that, kind of on the flip side, after we moved to Wyoming, we ended up drawing a decent tag probably about 4 years ago. And
I'm sorry, how many years ago?
About 4 years ago.
Four. Okay, I thought you said 40. Mike, geez, I didn't think you were that long. All right.
No, so my son and I put in as a party, and we had packed in with the horses, and we're sitting on this the edge of this great big park, just kind of waiting for it to cool off, and hopefully we'd hear a bull bugle and we could make our way to him. Oh, one lit up, and we gathered our stuff and ran for the edge of the trees kind of towards him, bugled a couple times, and he was absolutely on fire. And he came up, he was coming up out of the bottom right at us, and then he obviously, there was just a little bit of a fold in the terrain, and so he was actually coming up on the other side of this thick draw. And I could tell he was going to circle above us. So he was probably only 35, 40 yards away from me, and my son was about 15 yards in front of him, or in front of me. So once he got high enough, he was just about level with us. I hurried up and ran down the hill about 15 or 20 yards to get my son right between him and I. I knew there was a game trail right there. I'd already seen it. And I bugled, and this bull came right down that game trail and right past my son at, his rangefinder said, 4.8 yards. And he drilled him with a broadside shot. So, you know, if you do it right and are paying attention to those things, it can work. But there's so many things that can go wrong. And if you get focused on not the big picture, but you get, you know, focused on little things, it's so easy to overlook those bigger things that can all get you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and you got to be able to recognize, you know, the terrain and recognize the obstacles and all that stuff, and use that to your advantage. And it's
yeah.
When you were telling the story about the one that you shot and you only got the 6 penetration, it made me think of, it's not really in the same category of why it went wrong, but it made me think of a bull that I did something similar, only because you said he went back with the cows and everything. And I'm gonna, the lesson learned here is that, well, let me tell the story and then I'll explain it. So I was with my buddy Bill, and I had my cameraman with me, and we called this bull. We were trying to call the herd bull, but the satellite bull started coming, and it was getting late in the hunt. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to take this guy. I saw him coming. I could see the tips of his antlers coming. And I was probably, I don't know, 25, 30 yards ahead of Billy. And Billy was calling. He was cow calling. And he had I had hung my Montana decoy in the tree in front of him, so that when this bull came crested over, I had this like just a little rise over between the bull and I, like from where I was sitting. As soon as he got to like 20 yards on the other side of the other of the rise, I could see his antlers coming. So I had ample time, you know, to draw back and have him crest the top of that rise. And I was only 30 yards from the top of the rise, like 28 yards actually. So he's coming. I draw back. I'm at full draw, but it was pretty windy. And yeah. I didn't think about it. You know, in the when it's just a light breeze, it makes that, you know, that decoy move a little bit and kind of gives it some realism. But when it's windy, that thing's flopping around like a kite, you know, and like a plastic bag hanging from a bush, you know. It's like so it got really gusty at that moment, right? When he was coming up, and as soon as I was about to let off, he saw that, you know, that decoy flapping in the wind, and you know, it flipped over to the white side of it or whatever, and I shot, and right as I shot, he, like just as I shot or just before I shot, he jumped, and he was facing me directly, and I literally hit him in the ass. That's how he spun all the way around, and I hit him in the ass. And but the next day he was bugling and running around after cows. That's what made me think of that story. But the lesson learned in there is, like, you know, you're trying to create the illusion. You're trying to set this, you know, again, go back to setup, but you're not paying attention to everything, you know, because you get really laser focused. Oh, I'm going to get, oh, this is slam dunk. I'm going to get him to come up to the hill, you know, this, and that. And I just wasn't paying it. Like, I know better not to use that thing when it's super windy because of that very same thing. But now it's ingrained in my head. If I ever use the decoy, that I gotta have the right condition for it, not just the right situation but the right conditions. So
I have one, not one that you can hang in a tree, but one that has like a couple little steel stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's okay. I've used it a couple of times, never to what I only one time that I thought that might have helped. But it's such a pain to kind of twist up and roll up.
Yep, they're easy to open, but to get them back to where you want them. So if it doesn't go right the first time, and you want to pack up and move or whatever, it's kind of a pain in the ass. No, I agree with you. I've used them for crossing like open areas when I know there's no chance in hell I'm getting across this without getting seen, and it's worked to my advantage. As far as calling setups, I don't think I've used them too many times after that last time. And that was way back in, that was either 2014 or yeah, it was 2014 that I did that. But I use them quite a bit for deer. Especially in South Dakota, again, because we're crossing big open expanses and stuff. I've had a lot of luck with that. I actually had some, the guys over at Montana Decoy worked with me and made me a few cow decoys, and I'm moo moo cow decoys, you know?
Yep.
And, I use the hell out of those during deer hunts because they're big enough to hide behind. And you know, when you're hunting cattle country, it's like, it works real well.
Yeah. They're used to seeing that. So that's no big deal.
Yeah. But in calling situations, unless I'm in a spot where the room that we were talking about earlier, is too big for me to shoot with a bow, and I know I'm not going to get them to cross something, that is the only time that I will use it. I've used it a couple times in that same scenario that I just gave you, mainly because I want them to come up to the top of that ridge and look and stare for a minute, you know, give me that 5-6 seconds I need to whatever to squeeze off a shot. But other than that, yeah, I'm not that I'm not a fan of them. I just, they're cumbersome to me. Just like you said, it's a pain in the ass to open, set up. The ones with the stakes, forget about it. Those are like, you know, who the heck wants a cat? I mean, and they've done a good job with them, and people use them really. There's guys that use do really, really well with them and use them really effectively. I've even tried the ones on the bows, the stalker ones, what the heck are they called? Ultimate Predator. Danny Ferris owns that company. And
I've heard him talk about them before.
Yeah. And I've used those a couple of times too, but then if it's windy, it's going to affect your shot. You know, you're fighting a kite, you know.
Yeah.
You got a big sail on your bow. And so most of the places that I want to use it is pretty windy stuff, but I've had some opportunities and I've used it before on mule deer and whatnot, but you know, it's like everything else. You know, everything has its place. And if you're smart and you got all the tools with you, you can make it work. So
I haven't even packed mine for, I bet, 10 years or better.
Yeah. Again, it comes on I carry it. The one that I carry for elk hunting is it's fairly compact. And if I just put it on my meat shelf on my backpack, so it's like really super easy for me to carry around and not even know that it's there unless I need it. I carried it on this last season. I carried it here in Arizona. I didn't end up using it because I just didn't feel like I had a situation where I needed it. I think in thicker country, it's not really a necessity because you got more of those rooms that we were talking about. You got more. He has to break a certain point to see what's calling. So you don't need him to stand or come closer with his eyesight. So
I hunt by myself quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of times I end up trying to gauge their aggression and close on them and just kind of read all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And balance it all out. But I will try to put something that's not going to stop them, but will make them more likely to not expect to see not expect to see that animal calling until they're within range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like some kind of patch of trees or something that is easy enough for them to go through, but they still couldn't see what they think is calling at them until they're close enough to actually shoot.
Yeah. The setup is just as important as, if not, it's actually more important than your ability to call. I always say set up first, knowing the language second, and then actual calling skills third, you know.
I would agree. The knowing the language, you know, being able to gauge how aggressive you can get is, you know, it's something that it's really hard to put in words.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to mess up a lot. You'll be too aggressive on a bull that's not very cooperative and, you know, just kind of doing more locate bugles and just hanging out versus the one that is fired up, that, you know, is up there raking trees and closing distance and, you know, being able to judge what kind of bugle you're listening to and how aggressive he is pretty key in knowing whether you are safe to, you know, get that aggressive and literally run towards him. And of course that comes with its own problems because sometimes they sound further away than they are and you get aggressive and then you get busted.
Yeah. Yep. I did that my first night ever hunting in Oregon. I was with my buddy Corey and he was calling for me, and this bull, we heard him. We had located him from across the drainage that we got down and around, got the wind right and got on the same side as him. And Corey lets out a bugle and I hear him up above us. And what I thought was probably, I don't know, 100 yards maybe. And over there is crazy. It's freaking jungle. So 100 yards might as well be 300 yards. So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna run up there, and I could see a game trail coming down through these two fallen trees, and I'm like, he's gonna come right there. So I ran up there real quick, and I was flopping my leg. I was gonna stay right there on that one thing, and I'm like, you know what? I better get on the other side of this tree. And I got it, stood up again, and I flopped my leg over the tree, and I was just gonna sit down on the other side, and I look up and he's staring right at me at like 25 yards. And I'm like, shit, I screwed that up. But
yeah,
he was coming. I should have just waited with my original plan. But I didn't.
And yeah, I've been busted a lot.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't, then you haven't been doing it long enough. So
yeah.
Anyway.
Yep. The wind, getting seen by them because you're moving, any number of things can go wrong.
Yeah, that's for sure. Absolutely. Well, do you have any other stories with us before I let you go?
You know, I guess that the only other thing that I could kind of come up with, it's not necessarily a story, but it's more of kind of an encouraging people to not set too high of expectations on new hunters. When I first got married, my wife was from Iowa, so she really hadn't been out in the mountains, and we're sitting, and I was in decent shape, and so I drug her all over the place, and she complied, but wasn't necessarily happy about it and didn't always enjoy it. Then I did the same thing with my daughter, but I had scaled it back a little bit. And then by the time that my son was hunting, I had scaled it back quite a bit. So I guess the biggest thing is, if you bring in new hunters, especially ones that have, absolutely no experience in, just like that mental toughness of being able to push through the suck fest of climbing some hill for an hour and a half in the dark, just have your expectations a little bit lower and try to, especially with kids, try to make it fun,
right,
as much as possible. I mean, there's only so much fun you can have when you're walking 25 yards and stopping for a breath because the hill's too steep. But if you can do something to try to make that a little more enjoyable, you have a better chance of that person, even if they decide they don't want to, be shooting animals, at least tagging along with you and enjoying the time in the woods with you.
Right. Well, thanks for sharing everything with us. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I will talk to you soon. You didn't end up drawing a tag, did you, in Wyoming?
Well, I drew some tags. I didn't draw a bull tag. I drew a leftover cow tag, so that allows me to shoot an extra cow.
Oh, cool.
And then a second choice antelope for the same area that I had hunted before. We talked about it, that I hunted last year. We talked about it last year a little bit because I had never hunted it. And I got an extra whitetail buck tag. Well, I think it's for either sex, but I'll try to shoot a whitetail buck.
Nice.
So I have a few tags, just not the bull tag I was hoping for. So I'll be hunting general season, and which means if you're hunting in the bighorns in the couple of general areas that we have here, it's only a 15-day season. You have to go over to the western side of the state for the general areas to open on September 1.
Gotcha.
So I might try to do a little bit more, especially since I have that whitetail tag, I might try to do a little bit more of some mule deer hunting.
Oh yeah.
And so I haven't done too much of that. I don't care to eat them that much. Uh-huh. I think whitetail taste a lot better. So
yeah, they do.
Yeah. If I'm chasing a deer, it's going to be whitetail over mule deer.
Yeah.
But I would like to shoot, especially in the velvet, I'd like to shoot a nice buck in the velvet.
I've yet to kill a big velvet mule deer.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't, if it was in a velvet, I probably wouldn't be too picky about size.
No, I've killed quite a few of the 130, 140 ish, but never anything giant or well, not giant, yeah. But anything big, you know, that 170 or better. Man, I don't know what it is. I just, when it comes to velvet, I don't know if it's because I fell apart, because I've had some opportunities and I've freaking screwed them all up. I just,
I don't know.
I'm definitely better hunter during the rut and hard horn stuff, but I don't know. Maybe one day I'll figure it out, but.
And I've never been super serious about deer hunting. I mean, I go out a lot, but I just like playing with the elk during the rut. Mm-hmm. And so especially growing up in Western Montana, where it was a little thicker and there wasn't a lot of spot and stock opportunities for those mule deer. You know, they'd come out in openings, you know, meadows or logging clear cuts. And, you know, and then they go back in the thick timber to bed down. So it's not like you could spot them and stalk them. Mm-hmm. We'd try a few times to ambush them, but that was only if the elk weren't bugling. They were kind of an afterthought.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I've had many, many opportunities. I just had something always goes wrong for me. And I think I've been in my own head. There's a few species, not necessarily species, but few animals in situations that I've screwed it up a couple of times. And now that I've screwed it up a couple of times, it's like, they become like a Moby Dick for me, you know? And I just got to get out of my own head.
Yeah. Did I see that you ended up with a pretty decent tag in Utah?
I did. I got one of the Hunt Expo tags, one of the conservation tags for Books Cliff South. It's a rifle tag and it's late October. It's just before the rut. And it is in an area that if the weather is harsher, the better off I am. But if it's really mild, it could turn into a pretty tough hunt.
Okay.
So, I mean, I have high expectations for it, but, and the other shitty part of thing about it is that for everybody that I've spoken to, and I don't know this for sure or not, but, I'm going to get a hold of a biologist over there, has told me that don't even bother going to do any scouting in the early fall or, you know, early fall or late summer, because those bucks are not going to be in those areas when your hunt's on. So that being said, you know, I'm still obviously very excited about it. I just don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
So now I know that tag, when I started putting in for it 15 years ago, was like one of the best tags. It was like drawing a strip tag in Arizona. Was one of the top. It is no longer that high a caliber of a tag. It's still a very good one. I know the elk hunting, I think, over there is supposed to be pretty amazing too. There's bison and all kinds of other animals, but sheep, I think, too. I'm not even sure. I do got to get over there and just get at least a little the lay of the land and get some eyes on some stuff, but I don't really have any. I have an Idaho tag. I'm leaving next two weeks from now for California to hunt blacktail. I haven't been in 2 years, so I'm excited to get back. It's normally my first trip of the year every year. And then what else? We got South Dakota mule deer in November. So today the results came out. Well, not the results, but the cards are getting hit for Arizona. And so far, the card that I use for my kids got hit. So looks like we got two tags for the kids. I don't know what. Looks like a javelina tag and a deer tag, but I don't know who got what. So so that means early October we'll have some hunts for them. Then deer hunt here and probably going to go in August. I don't know yet. Like I said earlier, I'm kind of worried about the deer herds. I don't know if I'm going to go be that guy and take another deer out of the herd. And then I'm debating whether or not to go to Oregon. It depends on what we draw for clients and stuff for the deer. But I want to go chase blacktail in Oregon during the rut in the late November, early December in southern Oregon. And I think, you know, that's it. I'll finish up over here with deer and javelina. And, you know, for me personally, anyway, I don't know how many hunters I'll have for deer or whatever yet, but I should know soon.
Good deal.
Yeah. Pretty exciting. It's always exciting this time of year. Everybody's chomping at the bit. So,
yep.
All right, buddy. I'll let you get back to work and, I will talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.